So here we go again. Next up is Martin Schwenke from IBM Australia, telling us something about restructuring the CTDB.
Thank you. Stefan Carnier is giving a fabulous talk next door, so if you're in the wrong room, no takers. Okay. So my name's Martin. I've been on the Samba team for a couple of years. I work for IBM, where I work on IBM's wonderful software-defined storage product, Spectrum Scale. I heartily recommend to you it all. It is an honor and a pleasure to work on it. Okay, there's the ad. So over the last year, I gave a talk about what I thought we needed to do to CTDB, and I'll do a very brief recap of that, and then I'll describe the reality of what's happened and the next couple of things that I think we're going to do. So yes, we're talking about Samba and CTDB. And for those of you who don't know what CTDB is there anyone in the room who doesn't? You've got TDBs on two nodes. CTDB shuffles records between the nodes for you. It does some other stuff, but you don't want to know that. So here are the things that CTDB does. Okay, does cluster management. So nodes come, nodes go, CTDB notices, and there's also an election for what we currently call the recovery master. It's a cluster database and does database recovery when nodes come and go in the cluster. And that's probably its most important task. Should have put it at the top. Right now, it's still a cluster-wide messaging transport for Samba. Sorry? Yes, fixing that. It does service management and monitoring. So if you're running Samba with CTDB, CTDB will normally start Samba when it starts, stop Samba on a node when CTDB stops, and it will monitor Samba to make sure that it thinks it's there and fail over IP addresses if one or more services disappear. So CTDB does all of this, and somebody reminded me that, you know, when CTDB started, there weren't a lot of ways around of doing all this well. So Tridge and then Ronnie built a lot of features into CTDB in a reasonably tightly integrated way, and that was a good thing. So,
for a while.
Thank you. That leads me to my next stuff, the plan. Okay, so what's the goal? CTDB scalability and performance. Let's go back. So we want CTDB to be scalable, and we want it to fly. We want it to be fast. We want it to be what people choose to do Samba clustering and perhaps cluster some other protocols. Right now, that's hard to do because of stuff that's further down on this slide. The other thing we want to do is we want to stop new developers running screaming from the room when they first download the CTDB source code and look at it. Right now, there are two people, Amitai and I, who are full-time on CTDB. There's some other people who dabble, but there isn't a lot of other developer interest. So we'd really like to get more developers interested. And to do that, we've got to hold their attention and not have them run away screaming because all the code is kind of jumbled in and they just wanted to tweak something to do with IP failover and it's mixed into the database recovery code. And, you know, listening to some talks this morning and people being excited about some changes in CTDB, another goal is obviously to encourage wider use. We don't want this to be a niche thing. We want to take over the world. So for the first point, what might we want to do? Well, we might want to parallelize the CTDB daemon. The very simplest low-hanging fruit, once we've got over an initial hump, would be to have a database daemon per database. That would be really simple to do. You know, I suspect that would be weeks of work once everything else is out of the way. So that means we need to remove the non-database functions from the database daemon, and currently it's monolithic. So we need to cleanly split out the cluster management, the service management, and the IP management. And that turns out to be quite tricky. So how do we get there? Well, I gave a talk last year where I outlined a fabulous plan for what we could do with CTDB and some exciting ideas. And so far, it hasn't looked a lot like that. So far, it's been an untangling exercise. So last year's talk assumed that, you know, we would have some clear time to do some sort of greenfields development. But in between, you know, handling bug reports and stuff, it's got to be much more of an incremental effort. So this talk is about how we're getting away with doing it incrementally. It's been slow, and, you know, it's like eating an elephant. So it's one bite at a time. So the last 12 months of untangling. We've touched all of these things, and I'll just go through them one by one. So Amitai talked last year about how we ended up with a Samba CTDB deadlock situation during database recovery. It ended up being a very simple deadlock. In early days of CTDB, Samba would lock one record in a database, in one database, and then unlock it. But more recently, in the Samba 4.x versions, Samba would take a lock, and it would have a lock on a record in the database. And then it would go for another lock, and it would say, oh, that record isn't there. I need to migrate that record. And it would send out a migration request. And then the node that was going to answer that request goes away. So it doesn't answer, and you end up with a database recovery, and you've got a lock on a record. And you can't recover databases while somebody has a lock on a record. So Amitai separated out. He wrote a lot of code. He'll talk about this later. And he parallelized recovery in an external helper. So every time we want to run a database recovery, we fork an exec, basically. You know, it might be vfork an exec. So, yep, he wrote a lot of new protocol and client code to support it, and we have this new helper called CTDB Recovery Helper. So this is all new code. There are no nested event loops. This is all written using T-Event Rec, clean, beautiful, and at some stage in the near future, so this was in 4.4, so in 4.5 we can probably safely throw away the old serial recovery code, maybe. Just delete it. Seems like a good idea. And yeah, so it's a drop-in replacement for the existing recovery code, which could have also been, well, separated into a helper, but it would have been ugly. So the next thing that we decided to look at was NFS support. This doesn't really fit in with the rest of the talk, but, well, it kind of does. But one of the goals of a lot of the other changes is to get code out of the out of the daemons, Gesundheit. But in this case, we're just dealing with scripts. So what happened? We had 60.nfs as an event script, and we had another event script called 60.ganesha, and they both handle different types of NFS. And then somebody opened Samba Bugzilla and wanted 60.clusterNFS. And this seemed like a bad idea, and there were some other reasons that I won't go into, but it seemed a good idea to get rid of 60.ganesha as well. So the idea is to just refactor everything into a single 60.nfs script, and then you go, well, all of those NFS subsystems are really quite different to each other. So we have a CTDB NFS callout configuration variable, and you can write your own callout. If you're bored one weekend and you write your own NFS server and you want CTDB integration, then all you need to do probably is write a shell script, set CTDB NFS callout to point to your shell script, which is your helper, your callout, and you have clustered NFS for your nice new NFS server. Anyone have plans? Okay, so we ship a default call out for NFS called NFS Linux kernel call out. The sample, the Ganesha call out is only provided as an example because I wrote it given the last version of 60.Ganesha. I never tested it. I just thought it'll look something like this, put it into the docs directory and left it there. And in the last couple of weeks, a cool guy has been talking about how to make it usable with Gluster instead of just GPFS. And I think Jose is going to sort of maintain this once we pull it out of the docs directory. What do you think? Nice try. Okay. So I think he's going to maintain. No. Okay, what did we look at next? Okay, given that we want to untangle the IP takeover part of CTDB from the rest of it, the IP allocation algorithm part should be quite simple. It doesn't really need any of the rest of CTDB. It just needs a bunch of data gathered up and then handed to a function, which then calculates the new layout of IP addresses and passes that back out. So that seemed like a reasonable thing to attack. The CTDB data structures were deep in the IP allocation code, so it wasn't just a matter of moving the code to a separate file. And there were several sort of interface points between the IP allocation algorithm and the surrounding code. So it wasn't just one simple function call. So played around, introduced some more abstract data structures. IP allocation is now a separate module, separate.c file with its own .h file, and basically one function that you run. And you know, the next step might be an IP allocation daemon or a helper or something. We'll talk about that a bit more later. So the next thing we looked at was NAT gateway. NAT gateway is a bizarre feature in CTDB. If you don't want to put a static IP on every interface that has public addresses on it, then you can end up with a situation where you have no public addresses on a node and it has no route to infrastructure like DNS or the Active Directory server. So Ronnie invented the NAT gateway idea as a way of having all the nodes NAT out through a master node that does have connectivity to, or is likely to have connectivity to the infrastructure. This was supported by a single bit of daemon code which handled a NAT gateway master capability. If the master capability was set, which it was by default, then the node could be the NAT gateway master and kind of be elected or calculated as the master. If you set a variable called CTDB NAT gateway slave only, then that node couldn't be the master and could only be a slave node if it lost its IP addresses. And this code sort of pervaded the... it didn't pervade the IP allocation stuff. I just wanted it out of the daemon. I figured that I could get rid of it. We had a command CTDB NAT gateway list that calculated the NAT gateway master node, and I also reported a bit of status. And as I've already said, if the capability was unset on a node, that indicated slave only. Now, one thing you can do instead of having that capability built into the daemon is just stick a slave only keyword in the end of the nodes list for a particular node in the NAT gateway configuration. So you have IP address, IP address, IP address. You put slave only next to one of that. You do it consistently in the nodes, NAT gateway nodes file on all nodes. And it's the same as having the capability. So we got rid of the daemon support for that capability. And there's a new helper script called CTDB NATGW. And it can print the details of the master node. It can list all the nodes in a NAT gateway group. It can tell you the status of all of them. And the nice thing is it's a 100 or so line shell script. And it's now a complete, just an add-on. And now the nice thing is that if you want to use the ctdb command, because the helper is tucked away in a hidden directory somewhere, but if you want to find out any of the NAT gateway info, you just type ctdb natgw, one of those things, and it runs the helper, which is completely sensible, and it means that you've only got sort of one exit point from the tool to doing NAT gateway stuff. The NAT gateway event script also calls out to the helper, and that's the end of the talk. Oh, thank you all for coming. No. I turned off everything, but anyway.
Including the screen?
Yes. Dark days we live in. Okay, so NAT gateway support in CTDB is now completely non-core. It's in two scripts, and it doesn't get in the way of anything else. CTDB has had LVS support, Linux Virtual Service support, for a long time. Ronnie added it. We never knew if it worked. And we had two bits of daemon support there, an LVS capability, meaning you could do LVS at all, and single public IP, which was the way of configuring the IP address that you were using for LVS. So the only, so you, well, anyway, we had a command ctdb LVS master, which calculated the master node and was used in the event script for LVS. And what was the other thing about LVS? There was really no good reason for it to be in the daemon. And once I'd realized how we could redo NAT gateway, I also realized we could redo LVS the same way. So it's been re-implemented using the same model as NAT gateway, new helper script, CTDB LVS. LVS support is reduced to two non-core scripts. And now we don't have that single public IP pervading the IP takeover code. So when we go and split out the IP takeover code, we don't really need to worry how it interacts with LVS, except that we currently rely on one of the events in LVS, but that will be easy to fix because we can have a generalized call out to say, reconfigure your stuff, reconfigure your IPs. Okay, the next thing which came up in the middle of the NAT gateway stuff was TCP connection killing. So we had a combination of a ctdb kill TCP command, which would take a pair of socket addresses, pass them to the daemon, and the daemon would do the killing for us of the TCP connection. So the daemon validated the server-side IP address to make sure that you weren't killing connections for any address or an address you didn't own, but ctdb would never try to do that anyway. The daemon sent TickleX, listened for responses by sniffing using a socket, and then sent resets. So, there's really no need to validate those server-side IP addresses, which means you don't need to do it in the daemon at all. So now we've got a new helper, ctdb kill TCP. So it reads connections from standard input. You can run a fancy SS command that where you give it the IP address of connections you want to kill, and it does the filtering for you, no awk. And then you feed those into ctdb kill TCP, and it'll kill your TCP connections. That's a little C program, I don't know, 200 or 300 lines, and it's now completely separate. It's much faster than talking to a daemon to ask the daemon to kill every connection, sending a control back and forth saying, kill this connection, please. Thank you. Kill this connection, please. Thank you. One thing we found during the implementation, this is a bit of an assumption. We haven't confirmed it, but we use a packet socket to sniff the packets going by. So does anyone not know how TickleX work? It'll only take 1 minute. Does anyone want to know about how TickleX work? There's a bit of a nod. Okay, so you send a sort of arbitrary ACK packet to the client. You know the client's address. You send them an arbitrary ACK packet. And in our case, we put the, I think it's the window size, we put a marker of 1, 2, 3, 4 in there. And then we listen for a response because, and we send a sequence number of zero or random or something, I can't remember. It doesn't matter, but the sequence number is wrong. And then the client goes, no. And it sends an ACK with the correct sequence number. We sniff for that, and then we go, ah, now we've got the right sequence number, reset. And we send a reset packet with the right sequence number in it. So it's very simple, but we found that our sniffing was dropping packets and that, you know, I could send out, 1,000 Tikalak packets, and if I only listened once, then I'd only see something like 70 connections get killed, only send 70 resets. So what we did was we spent some time tuning that so that we now send the Tikalaks in batches instead of just... So what used to happen when you sent them to the daemon, of course, is you'd go, daemon, send a Tikalak for me, please. And it would go, certainly, sir. And it would send you a Tikalak, and then you would send the next request to kill a connection, and they'd kind of be a bit spaced out. But now we just go, phoomp. So now we send them in batches. The code has a batch size of something like 100. And we go, if we do something like 50 batches, so it can take up to a tenth of a second. We used to wait a whole second before trying again. But now we just send out 100, then we send out the next 100 of what remains. So we eventually kill all the connections. The other thing is, since we are so fast, the bidirectional killing packets got a bit mixed up. So you'd send out a Tikalak, and you'd send a Tikalak in the other direction, and you'd go, oh, there's my response. And you'd send a reset, and it still had the wrong sequence number in it. So what we had to do was go, well, if there is a window size of 1, 2, 3, 4, sorry, it's all over. So, yeah. This is no good. Da-da-da-da-da. Turn that off. Turn it back on. Hardware problems. Oh, I love it. Okay, so we did some internal filtering and tuning. And now that helper is invoked directly from the event script. No CTDB commands, no daemon involvement, and we just kill connections. And that means some people we know can also use this tool to kill their connections. The recovery lock. It used to be an FCNTL lock on the cluster file system, and many people have had problems with this. So it's taken on the first recovery, it's released on election loss, so it's not really a recovery lock anymore. It's a combination of a cluster master lock, because we hold it until we lose an election, and a recovery lock, because we take it the first time we do a recovery. We want to split this, because one of the things we're doing is splitting out cluster management and database recovery. And we want to allow other forms of cluster mutex than the FCNTL lock. So, took the existing code, spun out a new helper, CTDB mutex FCNTL helper. Or, if you don't want to use that, you can say CTDB recovery lock equals bang, something I wrote, which could be a script because the API is so amazingly stupid and simple. Give it your arguments in case you've got multiple of these mutexes, and it will run. So basically, the API goes, run the thing. If it manages to take the mutex, it should print ASCII character 0 to stand it out. If there was lock contention, it prints ASCII 1. And why ASCII? It's easier in a script, right? Errors that you want to see logged, you just print them to standard error. When you want to release the lock, when CTDB wants to release the lock, it sends a SIG term. And if you care and need to do something active to release your mutex, then you've got to catch SIG term, release your mutex. And you know, if there is a disadvantage, it means that your helper is running all the time. There's an extra process just sitting there doing nothing, but it's about this big. Haven't split the recovery lock yet. We'll get to that towards the end of the talk. Monitoring in the recovery daemon. The CTDB recovery daemon does not just do database recovery. It does everything. It makes coffee. It sings little songs.
Does Julian fries?
Yes, yes.
Does it take firstborns?
Does it take?
Firstborn.
Sure. Sure. It runs at twice the speed if you sacrifice to it. It has a thing called main loop that runs at 1 second intervals. It checks whether the IP addresses look right. It checks whether the recovery master node should still be the recovery master, you know, if it's active, if it's still got the capability. It checks consistency of flags across the cluster. It does database recovery. And all of this is intertwined. So every few weeks I get bored and I go and whack it with a big stick. And we're getting to the point where main loop is starting to look clean. I posted some patches earlier today. And, you know, there's about probably 3 or 4 sessions of whacking it with a big stick left before it should be gather some data, check some consistency of local node stuff on all nodes for elections or recovery master, you know, to do the cluster management stuff, do the database recovery-ish checking, do the IP management stuff, and then on the recovery master, do those three things as well. So, it, you know, main loop should end up being about this long. That's the plan. So, yeah, this is a continuous thing and has been for the past 18 months or so. So did anyone notice a pattern there? What was the word I kept using?
Whack.
Whack. Did I use any other words?
Split.
Yeah, and I used the word helpers. So in nearly every one of those cases, we took existing code and we stuck it in an external helper, and that turns out to be, so we have helpers. We have helpers. Sometimes we call them callouts, but they're really helpers. Yes.
Do they help?
Do they help?
Do they help like the dog helps?
Do they help like the dog helps? The dog brings you a beer. This is good. Anyway, so one way, if you're incrementally rewriting something, we found out, you know, after Amitai did the recovery helper and we were talking about some other bit of code, you know, he sat about with this, you know, evil laugh going,
That sounds like him.
Yes, yeah. And he said, we can use helpers for more stuff because then we can have new code written using T-Event Rec where it matters. And none of the stuff I'm talking about yet here is yet done like that, but it's just separate. And we can have nice shiny code. We can throw away old code. And eventually we end up with a database daemon that's old code. And then we, you know, we can do the sort of parallelizing thing. And then when we have a thing that handles one database, you know, I'm going to take and rewrite that in 3 hours after lunch one day. Yep. It's good. Okay. So helpers can be used for writing shiny new code to replace self-contained parts of the code. So all this stuff has been pretty self-contained. It particularly works well for infrequently executed code. You don't want to be forking and execing for stuff in your critical path unless you're running lock helpers. But Amitai did explain last year or the year before why executing very small lock helper turns out to be much faster than forking and execing a big daemon. Or just forking a big daemon, I should say.
And yeah, the good thing is that most of the code we want to move out is relatively infrequently executed because, you know, it's doing cluster management stuff, which isn't 20,000 a second or whatever, or 5,000 a second. It's IP stuff, which isn't thousands a second. And it's service management, which isn't thousands of things a second.
So, Martin.
Yes, Mike.
So I assume that depending on... So what's the point then?
Okay, I assume at some point you want to also split out stuff. I mean, if there is like a main some code has to invoke these helpers. So yep. I assume at some point you will split out daemons, like or daemons instead of helpers, like having a monitoring daemon and a recovery daemon and so on and so forth, something like that.
Yep.
Possibly. So
and
this is the kind of the many first steps until you are at the point where you can rip out daemons. Is that kind of the plan?
Yeah, we've got to do this until we get there. So we're getting close, I think. You know, I'm looking at the code now and I'm smiling because I'm thinking, you know, when all of the features were being added, I don't think anyone ever thought that there would be, you know, many cluster managers to choose from, that there would be, you know, that there would be choices for all of this. So, you know, nobody designed it that way. So yeah, I think we're getting close. You know, there are various things that are done infrequently, like elections, where I'm wondering if there is a mechanism where you don't need a long-lived daemon, where you can just have something registered to handle an event, basically. And you know, it's something we haven't talked about a lot, but yeah, the initial idea will be. In fact, I'll get to it. So yeah. Okay, so what's next? Okay, so I want to split the recovery lock, but at the moment we've got CTDB set rec lock, which can set the recovery lock at runtime. So if I'm going to have a cluster lock and a recovery lock, I've either got to implement CTDB set cluster lock as well, or we've got to ask questions about what happens when you've got a recovery lock that's meant to stop you getting a split brain, and you try to update that lock at runtime, and it fails on one or more nodes. There is no good failure mode there. There's no way you can be sure that you're going to get that cluster lock coherent again, except by banging on it repeatedly, and you don't know what's happening to your cluster while you're doing that. So, blah, blah, blah. Yes, so the whole idea is to drop support for CTDB set rec lock. And then immediately after that, I can add cluster lock and do the splitting of that functionality. Split out the election code, more on the next slide.
So the cluster lock would be the stuff that prevents split brain. And recovery is really for doing the recovery thing, or?
Yes.
So the question is, once we've got the cluster lock, do we need the recovery lock? And that depends on how you decide to handle a change of master or leader or whatever during recovery. If you want to be able to finish a recovery, even though the master has changed, then you probably still need that recovery lock. Whereas if you want to cancel it and abort it and start it from the new master node, then you'll only ever run one recovery at a time, so you might get away with just the cluster lock. But at the beginning, to maintain the current not very clear semantics, where nobody's actually made a design decision there. This is the thing, because nobody ever thought about splitting these things out. So if we just split it into two locks and have them overlap, then that's okay. So
I just want to add one more thing. Another thing is that election really and database recovery have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah.
So ideally you want to separate them in separate processes, and in which case it makes sense to have different locks because they are both can happen simultaneously.
Also, if you do the recoveries on separate databases separately, could... Well,
no, that's a different issue.
Okay. Yeah. So Amitai's point is that... for the recording, elections and database recovery really have nothing to do with each other. They can influence each other probably, but
it's worth having a separate lock and running them out of separate places and then figuring out if we need the extra recovery lock. Election handling. So this is getting quite easy. Most of the recovery master validation code is now looking quite clean. If we do split out the election handling, as I kind of mentioned earlier, would it be a separate daemon? Would it do the recovery master monitoring to make sure that the nodes have the right status and that this node can be the recovery master? Does it need to be a long-lived process? Can we just have something that handles events and, when one node sends out an election message, then suddenly all the other nodes are running something that can answer those messages. Public IP management and takeover. Amitai and I, a whole 10, wow. Amitai and I looked at how I'd separated this stuff out and went, yeah, the API is not pretty. We could improve the API. Then we currently fork out of the daemon to do IP address reloading. That could easily be a separate helper. It would be the smallest, one of the smallest things that only sends a few controls. So we will definitely do that, and that code will disappear out of ctb-takeover.c or wherever it is. Coming soon to a place near you is an IP takeover run helper, which gathers the information from all the nodes and recalculates the layout of the IPs and sends the appropriate controls. It's low-hanging fruit to separate into a helper. And like the current recovery helper, it can be made fairly self-contained. Because you should never be allocating IPs when you're in recovery, and you should do it afterwards, it would be really nice to move the public IP state out of some daemons and into a replicated database. And that means all you need to process, so basically the master node would run the thing that recalculates the IP layout, and then it would dump the new state into this replicated database, and it would say to all the nodes, release IPs, and they would look into the database and say, I'm holding these IPs, which ones shouldn't I be holding? Aha, okay, I'll release those. And then send back an ACK. And then the master node can just say, take IPs. And it can look into the database and go, oh, I should have that IP, but I don't. Let me stick that one on an interface. Done. And then it can send out this IP reallocated thing that we currently do so that things can reconfigure. So that would be really nice. Because that means we don't need a daemon that maintains this state, and things like the CTDB tool, things like the CTDB IP command, would go out into one of these helper scripts, and they could just access the database directly. They don't need to talk to the daemon because the state's no longer in the daemon. So you have really easy access to that data. Move the TCP connection tracking, the tickles, into a replicated database. Let's do that too. Instead of having another way inside CTDB to shuffle that stuff around between nodes and on timers or whatever. So for that one, we need a replicated database that's fast. I had an idea where we take the things we currently call persistent databases and we create a new sort and we just mount a TempFS and we put them in a TempFS. At the moment on a virtual cluster, we can get something like 10 transactions a second on a persistent database. But you're not going to talk about TempFS. On TempFS, you are?
Yes.
Damn. Okay, go to Amitai's talk. But needless to say, for this one, we need something fast. If you get a connection storm from to Samba
and you get 5,000 clients connecting and 5,000 Sambas trying to connect to CTDB in a second or two, you need to be able to pump those, that connection information into your connections.tdb as fast as you can.
Batch those?
Sorry? The simple thing is to batch them and throw them in every tenth of a second or something, in which case you don't quite have real time, but we don't quite have real time now because it's done asynchronously.
No, that's only for interface.
No.
No, for Samba it's done
real time. For Samba it's kind of done real time. It comes to one node and it says, and it replies after a little moment going done, but it's sent out async things to all the other nodes going, store this one. So if we batched them and did them every tenth of a second, I don't think we'd lose. So...
We can do real time?
Yes. And this talk brought to you by IBM Legal. Questions? All questions are answered. Everyone agrees. Does anyone? I'd especially like to hear if any of the developers disagree with any of this, because you know one of the reasons for giving this talk is that it's kind of a developer talk to share information with other developers about where we think things are going. Michael.
So I have to confess, I wildly disagree with what you've done. No, so many things, because as some of you know, I've been on part of that code, and it. As you said, it wasn't designed for stuff. I mean, most of the code wasn't designed. It was given us from above somewhere. So, thanks for these efforts. And it's like, I mean, I completely appreciate these efforts, and I also completely understand that this is nothing that I would expect you to have finished within the year or something.
I wish I had, but yeah. Oh.
Questions? Okay, that's not the case. So thank you, Martin.